From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Although it didn't get much coverage in a country where a terrorist attack on a house of worship is still unusual, and where bombs delivered to politicians do not explode, on Monday the UN Security Council considered yet again the situation in Syria. This was Mark Lowcock, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, reporting to the Security Council, which is presided over this month by the plurinational state of Bolivia.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Good morning. I concluded my briefing for you last month with a question. Would the agreement reached between the Russian Federation and Turkey on Idlib provide only a moment of respite, or would it represent the start of a more stable future for millions of civilians in that part of the country? We have seen a glimmer of hope in the weeks of relative quiet since the agreement was reached. It's extremely important for millions of people in Idlib that that remains the case. The stakes are very high because the alternative is humanitarian suffering on a scale that would overwhelm all ability to respond, devastating a population that's already weakened through years of conflict, displacement, and deprivation. Mr. President, the United Nations and partner organizations continue to reach people in need throughout Syria. Over the first 7 months of the year, in total across the country, an average of almost 5.5 million people were reached with life-saving assistance every month. In September, nearly 2.5 million people were reached with food aid from Damascus. That includes some people in areas that have recently come under the control of the government, with assistance often delivered through the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. However, in many areas that recently changed control, the United Nations has not had sustained access. We've discussed this with the Syrian authorities, who've made clear that areas under their control should now be reached in a comprehensive and regular manner from Damascus. They've also agreed to facilitate a greater number of missions and that we can more systematically deploy United Nations personnel with aid that's often delivered in partnership with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. We look forward to rapid implementation of that approach. It will allow our teams on the ground to undertake essential independent assessments of the situation and see more of who is being helped and how. At the same time, we will continue to submit plans for government agreement for cross-line access into northwest Syria. Mr. President, this leads me to a broader point I wanted to make about the approach we're taking to assessing and meeting humanitarian needs across Syria. The UN's mandate for humanitarian action, set by you in your series of resolutions, and also by the General Assembly in Resolution 46182, adopted in 1991, requires us to consult the government. We think that's very important. At the same time, our mandate also emphasizes the principles of independence, impartiality, and neutrality in humanitarian action, in particular to ensure that assistance is provided on the basis of need and not driven or determined by any other considerations. The humanitarian system is, as you know, financed on a voluntary basis. The main questions I'm asked by all those whose help I seek in financing humanitarian action everywhere around the world are always the same. How do you know what the needs are? And how do we know, if we give you money, that it will really get to the people who need it most? If people whose money we're seeking are not persuaded by the answers we provide to those questions, my experience is that they do not give us the money we ask for. So ensuring that we work on the basis of the humanitarian principles is both a matter of complying with our mandates, as we want and as we must do, but it's also a matter of practical necessity. I've discussed these issues in detail with the government on a number of occasions in recent weeks. These discussions have led to important agreements in extending the UN's ability to assess needs as comprehensively as possible, fully in compliance with our mandate, as we prepare the humanitarian needs overview and the UN coordinated response plan that we'll be publishing for Syria for 2019. I hope to be able to report progress to you in carrying out expanded needs assessment exercises in the next few months. Mr. President, the United Nations cross-border operation from Turkey has continued to reach hundreds of thousands of people in need every month. It has been scaled up in recent weeks to ensure pre-positioning of assistance as a contingency measure for the event of military escalation, as well as to provide winterization support. Nearly 1,000 trucks are delivering plastic sheeting, winter clothes and boots, heaters and stoves. Critical supplies also continue to be delivered into northeast Syria through the Al-Yarabiya border crossing from Iraq. In the first 9 months of 2018, over 750,000 people on average each month were reached with food aid through UN cross-border activities. Sustaining this is essential for those in need, both providing aid and supporting service delivery. It's for that reason that the extension of the provisions of Resolutions 2165 and 2393 remain of the highest importance. The Secretary General, in his report, and I now call upon the Council to renew the resolution for another 12 months. Cross-border operations continue to be very closely managed and monitored. We continue to take every step possible to ensure United Nations operations meet the highest standards. The way we do that was reviewed in detail earlier this year at the request of the Council, and we reported on it to you in June. We train implementing partners and local authorities on the implementation of international humanitarian law. We advocate for principled delivery of assistance with non-state armed opposition groups inside Syria. And we've developed a code of conduct signed by most non-state armed groups operating in northwest Syria, committing them to respect international humanitarian law. We also take all possible steps to ensure compliance with money laundering and counter-terrorism legislation applicable to the United Nations. Mr. President, let me turn to other areas of concern in Syria. In Rukban, on the Syria-Jordan border, the UN, in cooperation with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, had prepared to undertake a large delivery of assistance from Damascus for 50,000 people, a vaccination campaign for some 10,000 children, and a rapid needs assessment. The convoy was planned for Saturday, just past the 27th of October, but reports of insecurity along the route forced us to postpone it. The population at Rukban has not received assistance since January this year, and they are increasingly desperate. There are continuing reports of children dying due to poor sanitary conditions and a lack of healthcare. This dire humanitarian situation cannot be allowed to continue. The UN is ready and willing to proceed with the convoy immediately. So my message to all concerned is please make the necessary arrangements to ensure the security of the humanitarian personnel and the accompanying convoy so it can proceed without delay. Intense fighting continues to affect civilians along the east bank of the Euphrates River in southern parts of Deir ez-Zor Governorate. There have been reports of dozens of civilian deaths and more injuries as Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by international coalition forces, engage in hostilities in the final remaining ISIL enclave in Syria. Some 7,000 people have been displaced from Hajin due to fighting in recent weeks. Up to 15,000 remain trapped inside ISIL-controlled areas. An attack by ISIL on one of the camps where displaced people were staying has reportedly resulted in death and injury of civilians, as well as the abduction of more than 100 people. Some of them have since reportedly been killed. While I remain concerned also about the situation in Raqqa, I do want to report to you that the United Nations has had increasing access to the area. A September assessment mission by the World Health Organization found that health needs in Raqqa remain great, with an acute shortage of all levels of healthcare services in the city. Assistance also continues to be provided to Raqqa City in the northeast, with the United Nations and our partner organisations now reaching more than 600,000 people a month. So, Mr. President, in summary and in conclusion, there are five areas where we now seek the support of member states and of the Security Council. First, continuing implementation of the agreement between the Russian Federation and Turkey, and the prevention of a military onslaught on Idlib and the surrounding areas, the humanitarian impact of which would, as we have repeatedly told you, be absolutely devastating to the civilian population. Second, renewal for another year of Resolution 2165, in particular to sustain cross-border aid essential to support and protect more than 3 million civilians in Idlib, most of them women and children, and for essential supplies and services across the north of Syria. Third, support to ensure that our United Nations and Syrian Arab Red Crescent humanitarian convoy is granted secure access to Rukban camp immediately. Fourth, support for our efforts to improve access, needs assessment, and evidence gathering on how the resources we've raised are being used. And finally, continued and more generous financing for our current humanitarian response plan. While I am, on behalf of millions of Syrians who are the beneficiaries, extremely grateful for the $1.7 billion we've raised so far in 2018, this year's plan is still less than 50% funded. Thank you very much indeed.
After an hour of comments from various members of the Security Council, the permanent representative of the Syrian Arab Republic to the United Nations, Ambassador Bashar al-Ja'afari, addressed the Council.
Shukran, Sayyidi Rais. Adhumu sawti bida.
Thank you, Mr. President. I join my colleagues in expressing condolences to the people and government in Kindred, Indonesia, as a result of the disaster of that civilian aircraft. Mr. President, it is very much in bad taste that some delegations, Western delegations, are mixing politics and the humanitarian side of things. These delegations continue to set obstacles in the path of humanitarian access, which should be transparent, sincere, and non-politicized. These delegations claim that there will be no humanitarian action without responding to the strategic, ambitious designs of these countries. We have heard these same delegations set a number of political prior conditions that try to empty humanitarian action of all of its content and move it towards a political instrumentalization of the suffering of the Syrian people. Mr. President, I would like to recall that today's meeting is taking place or coincides with an attack committed by the so-called coalition against the Al Hajin region in Deir ez-Zor, using white phosphorus, which is internationally prohibited. This caused the death of an entire family, the mother, the father, and the children. The last meeting on the 24th of October coincided with a criminal terrorist attack perpetrated by armed groups in Idlib against Aleppo. This shelling saw the use of 40 missiles. Terrorist groups in Idlib launched 40 missiles against Aleppo, which killed dozens of people and injured dozens of civilians. On the 17th of September, coalition aircraft bombed Al-Susa and Boubadran in Deir ez-Zor, which led to the death of dozens of civilians as well. This was the session before last. All of that highlights and puts under a microscope the designs of the Western countries that have spoken about humanitarian needs in my country and who are attempting to manipulate OCHA, the United Nations humanitarian wing. Allow me, Mr. President, to congratulate you and through you, your country, the plurinational state of Bolivia, for the successful conduct of the work of the Security Council in October. Your presidency has genuinely taken care of the job entrusted to you by genuinely preserving, maintaining international peace and security and respecting the provisions of the Charter. Many member states of this organization are thus very proud of this excellent quality work done by the Bolivian mission. Mr. President, during the various meetings held recently between the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Mr. Lowcock, with Syrian officials, during those meetings, the need to coordinate common actions between the two parties for a better understanding and to remove obstacles and improve the role of the United Nations in the humanitarian sphere in accordance with General Assembly Resolution 46/182 governing OCHA, this need was confirmed at those meetings, and that in spite of a drop in the intensity of United Nations humanitarian action in Syria, which Mr. Lowcock spoke about, and a drop in financing due to unilateral coercive measures undertaken by the United States and the member states of the European Union against the Syrian people. And this demonstrates that tens of thousands of people need assistance due to these coercive measures, even though they say that the figures are quite different. The Syrian government is convinced of the importance of the role that its member states grant to the organization. Damascus continues to count on this role to help Syrians who have suffered from the terrorist war imposed upon my country, Syria. A role which will preserve the credibility and effectiveness of the organization, a role which would respect the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic. As your resolutions state, there are currently 28 political and humanitarian resolutions. They all confirm the need to preserve the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic and its people. A neutral, independent, objective role which does not chime with the blackmail of some countries is one that is based naturally on the Charter of the United Nations. Mr. President, we took note with very great interest of the briefing delivered by Mr. Lowcock and, of course, the report being considered. Allow me to make some remarks, which will undoubtedly answer the questions from some colleagues. First of all, there is a vital need to conduct a transparent, objective, professional dialogue to modify the information reporting mechanism concerning the humanitarian situation in Syria so that the objective of these reports can genuinely be to provide assistance to the Syrians that need it. Continuing to submit these reports on a monthly basis is a waste of time, money, and human resources. We affirm that they should be replaced by quarterly reports to the extent that much of the information in these reports is outdated information. For example, in the report before us, we are looking at what took place 1 or 2 months ago, whereas we should really be considering what is taking place at the moment in the current month. Secondly, there is an urgent need to have a transparent, objective, professional discussion of the content of these reports so that they are not used by some to exert pressure and blackmail. It is not reasonable and it is in bad taste when everybody has understood that there is a terrible terrorist war going on in Syria this year and that the sponsoring of terrorist groups is considered to be the chief responsible for this. We do not need to speak before the Congress and the Senate, which this month published the chief of staff and so on. This is not necessary because you know all of this already. And so, after it has been established that the government sponsor and financing of these terrorist groups has been recognized, and this has been acknowledged by all that these are armed terrorist groups which continue to take civilians as a human shield and which use hospitals and schools as a military base from which to launch their terrorist operations. Once everybody has understood that the source of lies targeting the Syrian government is terrorist groups and their champions, after all of that, it is then in bad taste for the authors of reports to continue to write their reports in a negative, politicized way against the Syrian Arab Republic and its institutions. All the more so because it makes many errors and deviates from its mandate and ignores deliberately the observations and remarks provided by the Syrian Arab Republic during previous reports to the Secretariat of the United Nations. 56 times we have presented formal responses to OCHA's reports. We have provided clear answers to all of the questions, but these comments were not relayed in OCHA's reports, never. For years, we have been trying to establish cooperation links with OCHA, and we ask OCHA for all of the necessary information, but our remarks do not attract the interest of OCHA officials. The remarks and observations from witnesses and the white helmets are relayed, but not the information provided by the Syrian government. Thirdly, it is surprising that the report claims that the government did not authorize the humanitarian convoy plan for September and October. What we heard today from Mr. Lo Hocock confirmed that. But the truth is that the government of my country asked the United Nations to include the liberated areas, which were included in the assistance plan as besieged or hard-to-reach areas. We asked for those areas to be included in the interagency convoy plan, in the humanitarian delivery plan, but the United Nations did not include these areas in the plan. I don't know what the answer to that is. You can ask Mr. Lowcock for that answer. Fourthly, when it comes to the delivery of assistance to Rukban camp, we know that if my geographic information is correct, we know where it is, because some have spoken as though this were a camp in Somalia or the Maldives. But it's not. It's in Syria. I can confirm that the Syrian government has given its agreement to United Nations institutions to deliver assistance to the camp in cooperation with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and the ICRC directly, because it's on the territory of the Syrian Arab Republic. But the United Nations group, after approaching the 55th kilometer on the 26th of this month, returned to Damascus quickly because of the deterioration of the humanitarian situation and because, according to reports, an imminent Daesh attack was going to be perpetrated against the convoy from the zone controlled by the Americans. And this is even though the United States gave the United Nations assurances as to the security of the convoy for the delivery of this camp, which is in Somalia. This is proof that the United States is impeding the delivery of assistance to Rukban, and that is the source of the suffering. Daesh has moved towards Suwayda and has attacked and killed around 300 civilians at dawn. These terrorists came back from Suwayda to the Altanf and Rukban area, which is in Somalia. Fifthly, my country regrets that the authors of the report, in accordance with the directive of some Western countries, are defending cross-border assistance, even though its ineffectiveness has been proven and it is not guaranteed that it will reach the destination of this assistance. And it also provides indirect assistance to terrorists who seize it and use it to fuel their terrorist activities in Syria. For months, we have been asking for many clarifications over this assistance and the assistance provided. We've still not received clarifications on that front. Mr. President, today, thanks to the safer, more stable situation on the ground, and thanks to the victory over terrorism, and thanks to the government's reconstruction of terrorist-destroyed areas and the return to normal life, the conditions are now in place for the voluntary return of Syrian refugees who had left their homeland due to terrorism and unilateral coercive measures, which deprive them of their means of survival, of their livelihoods. The return of thousands of refugees from abroad is happening, even though Western countries are trying to prevent them from doing so by intimidating them with weak pretexts and using humanitarian concerns as a card to implement their geopolitical designs, and setting that in between the political side and the humanitarian side. What we have heard today from the delegation of some Western countries confirms this. Lastly, Mr. President, as we are writing the final chapter in the Syrian crisis, Syrians are determined to work together to do away with the effects of the terrorist war and to rebuild their country with their own hands and thanks to their own people and capacities, whether it be those who have stayed in the country or those who have been forced to leave it because of terrorism. As for what was said by some about Idlib, I would like to remind all of you that Idlib is a Syrian city. No one more than the Syrian government has concern for the city and its inhabitants. They have been taken as a human shield by terrorist groups. My country reaffirms the Sochi Agreement concluded on the 17th of September. The Syrian government will continue to facilitate all attempts to cease the spilling of Syrian blood. We welcome all initiatives to bring peace and security to all of the Syrian territory that has been struck by terrorism. My government reaffirms also that it will continue to combat terrorism until it liberates the last part of Syrian territory from the grip of terrorists and all foreign military presence which is present illegitimately on Syrian territory. Thank you, Mr. President.
A U.S.-backed war on Syria, in Syria, has been waged by the United States and its NATO allies through local proxies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, among others, since March of 2011. Estimates of casualties from the UN and other international actors range from 400,000 to over 1 million dead, and millions more made refugees, both internally and internationally.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.